This is edition number 2032 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 28th of August, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 27th of August, 2026. My name is Mary Beattie, and my fellow readers are
Frances Doran, Julie Reeve,
and Madeline Gomez.
On the notice board today, please join us in wishing a warm welcome to Ruth of North Walsham. We hope you enjoy listening to The Mardler, Ruth. This week, the sun will rise around 6 and will set at about 10 minutes to 8.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes A Journey Rediscovered, National Trust Secret Library, My Music for August, Launching to Save Lives, and an interview with a foster carer from our roving reporter.
But we begin with the main news items, which include the future of an NHS site, fantastic GCSE results, Red Arrow's thrill, parish hall campaign, a Star Railway engine, World War II exhibition, flood defences, and school car parking. Let's start with those lead stories.
Hopes have been raised that a mothballed NHS site on the coast could get a new lease of life. An NHS boss is set to attend the next Save Benjamin Cork campaign meeting to discuss a possible future for the Cromer site. Benjamin Court, a reablement centre providing step-down care for hospital patients, was shut in June 2023 and has sat empty since. Beth Manning, Head of Clinical Transformation for Community Services and Older Persons at Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust, the NSFT, will speak about the possibility of creating a neighbourhood mental health hub there, organisers have said. The proposal follows the government's decision to open similar facilities. Ms. Manning visited Benjamin Court while searching for suitable premises for a hub in North Norfolk. Campaigners said she was impressed by what she saw. However, it is said the NSFT is unlikely to need the whole site, and campaigners want the remaining space used for health services, particularly post-hospital rehabilitation. The Save Benjamin Court group has campaigned for rehabilitation services to return. The meeting is to discuss what this could mean for the campaign to save and reopen Benjamin Court. The meeting is on Friday, August the 28th at 6 p.m. at Cromer Community Centre.
Teenagers across the North Norfolk area have been celebrating as they collected their long-awaited GCSE results. Schools reported a mix of high achievement and personal triumphs, with students praised not only for top grades but for their determination and progress. Sheringham High School shared in the celebrations, acknowledging both individual successes and collective effort. Dawn Hollidge, head of school, said, "We are incredibly proud of all our students receiving their GCSE results today. There have been some outstanding individual performances, and we are enjoying celebrating the class of 2026 this morning. A huge well done to all our students, and our sincere thanks to our dedicated staff and to parents and carers for their support and encouragement." In Cromer, 67% of students achieved grades 9 to 4 in English and Maths, with 50% earning grades 9 to 5. Principal John Vincent said, "Huge congratulations to all our students on your exceptional GCSE results. Your dedication, determination and resilience have enabled you to reach this important milestone, and we could not be prouder." Anya Gillies opened her results and said, "I'm beyond proud of my results. I couldn't have done it without the support of staff, my sister and family. I'm going to Sir Isaac Newton Sixth Form to study maths, biology and chemistry with the aim to become a surgeon." Aylsham High School described the morning as fabulous, with executive head teacher Duncan Spalding full of praise for the class of 2026. Mr. Spalding said, "A huge well done to the class of 2026 on a fantastic set of results. Once again, I am absolutely delighted and bursting with pride at what our wonderful young people and our amazing staff have achieved together this year. Their success reinforces once again what an absolute privilege it is to lead such a fabulous and inclusive school as AHS. We wish all our young people the very best of luck as they embark on the next stage of their education adventure, and we wish them well in whatever they choose to do in the future." The school also extended its thanks to teachers and support staff for their dedication and encouragement. Meanwhile, Reefham High School and College said this year's GCSE results were its best since the introduction of the 9-to-1 grading system. Head teacher John Croucher said, "We are incredibly proud of our students and of everything they've achieved. These results represent the culmination of 5 years of hard work, determination and perseverance, and our young people should feel enormously proud of themselves today. At Reefham, we very much see ourselves as a team. The success of our students is built on the commitment and dedication of our young people, our teachers and support staff, and the encouragement and support of parents and carers. It is that partnership that enables our students to achieve their very best." Students were also celebrating an impressive set of GCSE results at Alderman Peel High School in Wells, with many achieving grades 7 to 9. Matt Hardman, principal of the school, said, "To see them grow into such exceptional young people during their time with us and to see their hard work reflected in their exam results is something we are incredibly proud of."
Thousands of people gathered along the North Norfolk coast as the RAF Red Arrows put on a spectacular display for Cromer Carnival. Under clear blue skies, crowds filled the coastal town on Wednesday, with locals setting up deck chairs in front gardens to secure their own view of the world-famous aerobatic team. The hilltops around nearby East Runton were also packed with people waiting for the familiar roar of the jets, with some spectators even climbing on food trucks for a better vantage point. The Red Arrows arrived in Cromer at about 12:30 p.m. after flying from RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire. Their display followed disappointment for carnival goers after Cromer Carnival cancelled its planned fireworks display. But many people said the arrival of the Red Arrows more than made up for it. Crazy Bananas Clown, also known as Sally, said she'd been eagerly awaiting the performance. "When it came, I was jumping up and down like a child," she said. "Everyone from 1 to 100+ loves it. It's the most British thing, the red, white and blue. We need stuff like this at the moment. It's priceless." Ian and Libby Conway from Cromer were volunteering at the carnival and said the fly past held particular significance for them. "Ian is ex-RAF, so we find this really special," Mrs. Conway said. "We're really happy they managed to get back in time for the carnival." The display brought crowds to a standstill across the town as families, visitors and volunteers looked skyward for one of the biggest moments of this year's carnival. Cromer's streets then came alive as the town's annual carnival parade made its way through town, despite a dramatic spell of heavy rain and thunderstorms. Crowds lined the route to watch motorbikes and trikes lead the procession before the main parade left the carnival field on Runton Road at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. A colourful mix of illuminated floats, decorated vehicles, local groups and costume participants travelled through Cromer, bringing lights, music and spectacle to the town.
Campaigners attempting to secure formal protection for Cromer Parish Hall have been thwarted by council officials. Locals fighting plans to convert the building into flats and a shop had put forward an application for the hall to be listed as an asset of community value. But North Norfolk District Council has rejected the application, despite a growing number of objections to the development proposals. Cromer Parochial Church Council wants to close the hall around 120 yards from St Peter and St Paul Church, saying the move would reduce maintenance costs and help it manage its assets more efficiently. The proposals would see a retail unit take up about 75 PC of the ground floor at the northern end of the building, with a ground floor flat at the southern end and two further flats on the first floor. The total number of public objections for the proposal sat at 38 on Monday. Objectors and Cromer Town Council have warned the loss of the Church Street Hall would remove an important meeting place from the town, with no other large venue available for community use. Concerns have also been raised about traffic, the possibility that the flats could become holiday homes, and whether there's demand for another shop unit in the town centre. In a letter just published, the District Council said Cromer Community Association, CIO, was eligible to nominate the hall as an asset of community value, but concluded it did not meet the legal test required for listing. The council said the hall's main function was to support church activities, including office work and facilities used for the church cafe, rather than serving as a community hub. It also said that while there was some evidence of community use, church representatives had indicated those activities were limited to about 6 hours a week. It will now be placed on the council's list of unsuccessful community nominations for 5 years.
Enthusiasts are flocking to the North Norfolk Railway to see more than a century of British engineering. The 10-day Festival on Rails event runs until August the 31st and is seeing historic steam and diesel locomotives take to the Poppy Line between Sheringham and Holt, alongside carriages dating from Victorian times through to the 1960s. Visitors are able to travel behind a changing lineup of engines, with three working trains planned each day and as many as 9 locomotives expected to appear across the festival. Rover tickets will allow passengers to hop on and off throughout the day. One of the main attractions will be the N2 locomotive number 1744, which returned to service in July following an 8-year overhaul, costing around £800,000. The 105-year-old engine is the oldest surviving locomotive designed by renowned railway engineer Sir Nigel Gresley. Passengers can travel in the line set of 5 Victorian carriages, including the 1897 Great Eastern Railway Saloon No. 37, which is said to have been used by Queen Victoria's daughter, Princess Alice. Cream tea trains and the railway's Brunch on Board service will run on selected dates during the festival, and guided tours of Weybourne engineering works will be available. Pre-booked adult day Rover tickets cost £22.10, compared with £26 on the day, while children's tickets cost £15.47 in advance. General Manager Graham Hukin said, "Following the hot, dry spell, we've been supporting Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service, the NFRS, by limiting our steam operations for much of this month. In particular, by not running steam across Kelling Heath, which is vulnerable and difficult to access. We are keeping the situation under review, liaising closely with the NFRS, and our operating team has devised 2 versions of the timetable, both of which will see 2 steam engines and 1 diesel in action each day, so passengers can experience a variety of very special trains, whether the hot spell breaks or not."
A Second World War-themed exhibition will be held at a parish church showing how anti-aircraft crews set up home on the Norfolk coast. The Fading Memories exhibition is set to be held in St John the Baptist and St Mary Church. Organised by the Stiff Key History Group, the annual August Bank Holiday exhibition will take place from Saturday, August 29th until Monday, August 31st, running daily from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The exhibition aims to transport visitors back in time to the days of the Stiff Key Light Anti-Aircraft Training Camp, which operated from 1938 until the end of the Second World War. The camp, once a hive of activity, saw trainee gunners firing Bofors self-loading anti-aircraft guns at cloth targets towed behind low-flying aircraft. Photographs and videos will recount the lives of the various army regiments as they honed their anti-aircraft warfare skills. Visitors will also learn about the impact the camp had on the village of Stiff Key as the sudden influx of young men disrupted the peaceful tranquility of the 1940s. The exhibition will also touch on the camp's handover to American forces stationed in the United Kingdom at the end of the war. The exhibition promises to be a journey through the short but eventful life of the camp, offering a glimpse into a bygone era. Admission to the exhibition is free, as are parking and refreshments. Visitors will also have the opportunity to purchase a copy of the group's book, Stiff Key with Cockthorpe, A Story of Norfolk People, which details the history of the area. All donations collected will go towards the upkeep of the fabric of the Church of St John the Baptist and St Mary.
A major flood defence programme is set to take another significant step forward as work continues to modernise vital infrastructure. Plans to replace Repps Pumping Station near Great Yarmouth have been brought together with an ambitious scheme designed to strengthen water management for thousands of hectares of vulnerable land. The Broads Internal Drainage Board, IDB, has announced that Repps Pumping Station could become the fourth site delivered through the current phase of the Upper Thurne Integrated Drainage Improvement Project, alongside upgrades at Martham, Potterheim and Brograve. If final agreements are secured, enabling works at Repps are expected to begin within weeks, while major construction is scheduled to start in spring 2027. Robin Buxton, chairman of the Broads IDB, welcomed the proposed addition. He said, "It is really positive to see the Upper Thurne programme continuing to move forward, and the proposed addition of Repps is another important step in strengthening water level management across the catchment. Bringing Repps into the current package will allow us to build on that momentum and continue investing in infrastructure that is so important to local communities, businesses, agriculture and the unique environment of the Broads. The latest development comes as work continues at the three other stations already under construction. Sheet piling and excavation work have been completed at Martham and Potterheim, where reinforced concrete structures are now being built, while foundation works are progressing at Brograve. The wider project has already achieved a major milestone this year with the successful commissioning of new pumps at Horsey and St Bennet's pumping stations, the first two upgrades to be completed under the programme. The Upper Thurne project is replacing or refurbishing ageing pumping stations that manage water levels across more than 6,300 hectares of low-lying land. New stations will offer greater efficiency, increased pumping capacity and improved monitoring systems, helping protect homes, businesses, agricultural land and internationally important wildlife habitats, while preparing the area for future climate challenges.
The school run can often turn into a frenzy, but pick-up and drop-off times at one Norfolk primary school have become so bad that locals living in the same street say enough is enough. Norfolk County Council wants to expand the school in Cheney Avenue, Sulhouse, by constructing a new building which would accommodate 60 additional pupils. However, the bid has prompted outrage from people living in the road, who say it's overrun with inconsiderate parking at school drop-off and pick-up times. Some say they've even been abused by parents. One local said, Cheney Avenue and adjoining roads are already overrun with traffic from the school, creating traffic noise, antisocial parking and abuse to residents. Another added, the area around the school is twice a day gridlocked with parents bringing children to school. I'm aware of neighbours being harassed and nearly hit with a car being driven by a parent. A child might not be so lucky. I'm truly worried a child could be hurt, or even worse, because it seems if you don't live in the area, people drive at excess speed, as it's not my road. Fran Wymark, Conservative councillor for Salhouse on Broadley District Council, described the parking as chaotic. He said, I'm often contacted about the thoughtless and often dangerous parking and driving to and from the school. I know the school have asked parents and carers to be more considerate, but this is not respected now and will be worse with two extra classes. County Council officials say seven additional parking spaces are included in the plans, but papers for the scheme suggest these will only be for staff. Highways bosses say they are aware of the concerns and have proposed painting double yellow lines on the street.
Our next few news stories include meeting the man who cleans road signs for free, future of Norfolk Tip, football ground housing development, and new owners at Aylsham Care Home.
He is a Norfolk man on a mission to make our region's road signs more visible to motorists and make them more appealing to passers-by. Philip Bunning has been spending his spare time cleaning street signs across the county after becoming frustrated by their neglected appearance. Mr. Bunning, who runs PJB Exterior Cleaning Norfolk and lives in Taverham near Norwich, began the voluntary work shortly before Christmas 2025. Since then, the 50-year-old has cleaned more than 50 signs in villages and towns across the county. Mr. Bunning said he first noticed how dirty and overgrown some signs had become and felt they were making areas appear run down. I started cleaning street signs just before last Christmas, as I noticed they were neglected and just making the area look run down, he said. Mr. Bunning, who moved to Norwich in 2004 after previously living in Watton, said improving the visibility of road signs could also have a safety benefit for drivers. I would say it's making the roads a lot safer because the signs are more visible further away and can be seen quicker, he said. There should be less time that their eyes are off the road. Therefore, there should be fewer accidents. As well as removing grime, Mr. Bunning has removed graffiti from signs, including a well-known cat image on an NDR sign. He said some people had questioned why he removed it, but he viewed it as vandalism. Mr. Bunning has not received an official response from council bosses, but said many locals had been supportive. One woman recognised him while he was having his hair cut at Pop Silver Fox Barbershop and thanked him for his efforts. However, he said social media reactions had been mixed, with some people mocking his speech or questioning whether he should be carrying out the work. Mr. Bunning intends to continue cleaning signs, while also hoping to offer to clean patios and driveways for elderly people, bereaved residents and those living with serious illnesses.
The future of a former Norfolk Tip, which was shut to save thousands of pounds, is still not clear, 2.5 years since it was controversially closed. Maiton Wood Recycling Centre near Coltishall closed its doors for the final time in December 2023. Norfolk County Council, at that time under the control of the Conservatives, took the decision to close the site off Cromer Road at Little Hobbis to save £70,000 a year. The council said that usage of the recycling centre had dropped since the Norwich North Recycling Centre off the Norwich Northern Distributor Road had opened in 2021. The site was closed despite pleas from Liberal Democrat county councillors to keep it open. but nothing has happened at the council-owned site since, and officers at Norfolk County Council say they are still mulling over what to do with the land. A spokesman said no decision has been made yet regarding the future of this site. The council, as part of moves to save millions of pounds, had already shut recycling centres on Wednesdays and brought in a booking system for trips to the tip. However, the authority, now under the control of Reform following May's elections, does have plans to build new recycling centres in Norfolk. Plans to move Sheringham Recycling Centre had been on hold because of a legal fight over the lawfulness of the relocation. But after judges dismissed an appeal by the owners of Hilltop Outdoor Centre, which is next to the fields where the new tip would be built, the authority is all ready to push on with that project. And plans to replace the existing Wyndham Recycling Centre with a new one in nearby Spooner Row are due to be discussed by members of Norfolk County Council's Planning Committee in the coming months. Wyndham has been in line to get a replacement recycling centre for several years because hundreds of new homes are due to be built in and near the town.
A Norfolk Football Club's home ground has been put forward for a possible housing development again. Wroxham Football Social Club has been included as a potential site for new homes after council officials, who need to hit government housing and employment land targets, launched a call for sites. The latest submission for the Skinners Lane site covers more than four times the area suggested previously. Its entry on the list records a 7.76 hectare site put forward for housing within the report's 10 to 49 home category. However, the listing is not a planning application and does not mean homes have been approved, allocated, or are certain to be built. The land included is associated with Trafford Park, the current home of Wroxham FC, owned by Michael Trafford. Wroxham FC owns some of the land and the rest is on long lease with Mr. Trafford. In 2016, land at Wroxham Football Club was submitted through the Greater Norwich Local Plan's earlier call for sites process. That proposal covered 1.81 hectares and suggested about 20 homes. Planning documents said the earlier scheme depended on the football club, known as the Yachtsmen, finding a suitable new location. The previous submission was not taken forward, with concerns including access along Skinners Lane, the site's landscape setting and the practicalities and costs of replacing the club's facilities. Changed targets mean Norwich City Council, Broadland District Council and South Norfolk Council have to find sites which would provide almost 2,600 homes a year between now and 2046, having previously identified where 45,000 new homes could be built between 2018 and 2038. The government's target change has prompted a review of blueprint for where homes could be acceptable, known as the Greater Norwich Local Plan. That led the councils to appeal to landowners, developers and other interested parties to put forward potential sites so they can consider whether they should be included in a blueprint which will shape where housing and employment could be acceptable. Inclusion in the plan would make it more likely that future planning applications for sites would be granted permission.
A care home has welcomed new owners who say they are committed to maintaining its family feel. Aylsham Manor Residential Care Home, a 30-bed facility in the centre of Aylsham, has been taken over by Lionel and Pioshi Marceline following the retirement of previous owners Carl Dennis and Leslie King. The new owners were formally welcomed at a special event celebration held at the care home on Thursday, the August 13th. Pioshi Marceline said, "What drew us to Aylsham Manor was its wonderful family feel. Aylsham is a charming market town with a warm and friendly community, and it's clear that the residents here are genuinely loved and cared for. Our primary aim is to continue providing the highest possible standard of care whilst ensuring that Aylsham Manor remains a welcoming and homely environment for all our residents." Mr. Marceline praised the existing team and confirmed that all staff would be staying on under the new ownership. He said, "We knew Aylsham Manor was a well-run home with an outstanding team and high standards of care. We share the same core values of respect, dignity, independence and fulfilment for every resident. For that reason, we're delighted to be retaining the existing staff and management team. Their dedication to the residents has really impressed us, and we look forward to working alongside them as we take the home forward." The celebration brought together residents, staff, families and guests, including Councillor Michael Goodwin, his partner Veronica, and Reverend Canon Julie Boyd, Team Rector of Aylsham and District Team Ministry. The new owners also expressed their thanks to everyone who attended and to the staff for their continued commitment to the residents.
A canal, once full of boats, is set to come alive again to mark a landmark anniversary. Thousands gathered along the banks of the North Walsham and Dillam Canal on August the 29th, 1826, to celebrate the opening of the nearly 9-mile waterway. The route stretched from Wayford and Dillam through Stalham, Smallborough, Honing, Briggate, Ebridge and Spar Common to North Walsham, ending at Swayfield and Antingham. To mark the 200th anniversary, a weekend-long festival will take place at Oak Road in Dillam on August the 29th and 30th. A spokesman for the North Walsham and Dillam Canal Trust said, "This was a huge day, a massive event locally. Visitors can enjoy boat trips on the replica wherry Newen, a steamboat ride on Falcon on Saturday, canoe and paddleboard hire, a dog show, craft stalls and live music. There will also be archery, axe throwing, a licensed bar and street food. A special heritage display will share stories of the canal's past, including tales of crime along the route. Full details are on the North Walsham and Dillam Canal Trust Facebook page."
Overstrand Cricket Club is gearing up for its annual beer festival over the August bank holiday weekend. The celebration kicks off on Friday, August 28th with an open mic night at 7:30 p.m. On Saturday, August 29th, the main event begins with the first team home game at 1 p.m. with the bar open all day. The evening will feature a live performance by the band Raucous. Food will be provided by Chef Norgate and a variety of local beers, ales and ciders will be available. The festivities continue into Sunday, August 30th with a 40-over friendly cricket match and the traditional seeing off the barrels. The 3-day event is free for everyone to attend. The club has also announced that there are still a few barrels left to sponsor. Local businesses interested in supporting the club can get involved by contacting 07985 415545. The beer festival at Overstrand Cricket Club has become a popular fixture in the local calendar, offering fun and entertainment for all ages.
A 19-year-old apprentice has reached the final of a National Scaffolding Award. Tyler Boddy from North Walsham is in the running for the NACS Apprentice of the Year Award, becoming the first Norfolk scaffolding apprentice believed to have reached this stage. Mr. Boddy began his apprenticeship with SRT Scaffolding Services Limited at the age of 17. 2 years later, he's been recognised as one of the industry's rising stars. Danny Cooper of SRT Scaffolding Services said, "We're unbelievably proud of Tyler. He came to us at 17 as a young lad wanting to learn a trade, and 2 years later he's representing SRT and Norfolk at a National Industry Award. For a 19-year-old from North Walsham to achieve this is fantastic." Mr. Cooper said the company values investment in apprenticeships. He said, "We're a small independent Norfolk company and we've always believed in investing in apprentices and giving young people a proper opportunity to build a career. You don't have to be one of the biggest companies in the industry to train people properly and achieve high standards. Tyler is proving exactly that." Mr. Cooper said the team is delighted, regardless of the outcome. He said whatever happens at the awards, reaching the final is already a massive achievement, and we're extremely proud of what he's accomplished. Mr. Boddy said, I started at SRT when I was 17, and I've worked hard to learn as much as I can. To now be in the final for Apprentice of the Year at 19 is something I'm really proud of. I never expected when I first started that I'd be getting this kind of recognition. I'm grateful to everyone at SRT who's helped train me and given me the opportunity.
A holiday park on the North Norfolk coast has secured formal confirmation that it can be occupied throughout the winter. This comes months after planners refused a separate bid for year-round stays over safety and environmental concerns at the Backton site. North Norfolk District Council has granted a certificate of lawful use or development for Castaways Holiday Park on Paston Road. The decision means specified caravans and lodges can be occupied between January the 4th and the end of February, despite a condition attached to a 1992 planning permission requiring the site to be empty during that period. The council found that winter occupation had taken place uninterrupted for more than 10 years before the certificate application was submitted. Booking records supplied by the park showed occupation during the January and February restricted period in every year from 2016 to 2026. The planning statement said winter bookings included holiday makers, temporary accommodation for contractors working on projects connected with Backton Gas Terminal, and temporary bookings made by North Norfolk District Council. The outcome follows the council's refusal in March of a separate application seeking permission to remove the seasonal restriction permanently. That proposal was refused because the site lies within consultation zones surrounding Backton Gas Terminal, a major hazard installation. The Health and Safety Executive issued an advice against response, whilst planners also raised unresolved concerns about recreational impacts on protected European wildlife sites. However, the latest certificate application was not judged on whether year-round occupation was acceptable in planning terms. Instead, it asked whether the park had already breached the January-February restriction for long enough that enforcement action was no longer possible. The certificate does not permit permanent residential use, new caravans, or development beyond the area shown on its attached plan.
You are listening to edition number 2032 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 28th of August 2026. Still to come, there are items about parking concerns at Tesco, jet skiers warned, seal pup bite, and fishing boat's new lease of life, and of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, some local events.
Wednesday, the 2nd of September. Classics and Steam Evening at 5:30 p.m. A free evening event for classic vehicle enthusiasts to enjoy. Bure Valley Railway Station, Norwich Road, Aylsham. Info at bvrw.co.uk 01263 733 858. On the Edge at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are £14.50 to £22.50. And the website is sheringhamlittletheatre.com. Plus 2:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 2nd of September to the 5th of September at the Summer Repertory Theatre on the eroding cliff edge in a fictional Norfolk village, pensioner David awaits the oncoming storm that threatens his home. Rob White's play is one of the winners of the 2025 Coastal Playwriting Competition at Sheringham Little Theatre. Thursday, the 3rd of September, Wind Energy Museum Open Day at 10 a.m, tickets £5. Historic wind-powered machines, working demonstrations of Norfolk's drainage history, full-size wind pumps, children's activities, a model museum, and tea room. Tickets £5, £3 for children aged between 5 and 16. There are tours at 11:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. That's at the Wind Energy Museum, Staithe Road, Repswith Bastwick, NR 29 5JU. email is info@winergymuseum.co.uk. And the phone number is 07796 407 864. Life-changing waymarkers of the changing season, autumn, at 1 p.m, tickets £15. Autumn at Clay and Salthouse Marshes, a talk on migrating birds, seasonal change, and readings from David North's book, NWT Clay Marshes, Coast Road, Clay Next to the Sea. The email is info@norfolkwildlifetrust.org.uk, 01603 625 540. Silver Swing Along at 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Tickets £2 on the door, including refreshments provided by Stalham Broads. An over 50s musical afternoon, a community event for anyone over the age of 50. Songs from 60s and 70s sung by Darren Saw. A small raffle. That's at the Poppy Centre, Recreation Road, Stalham. Email is Alan, SCOTTETHAN, at gmail.com. 07557 550 127. A Place to Bury Strangers at 7 p.m. The Adrian Flux Waterfront, 150 to 162 King Street, Norwich, NR1 1QH.
We turn now to this week's Modeler magazine supplement, where we hear of a journey rediscovered, launching to save lives, a National Trust secret library, my music for August, and an interview with a foster carer from our roving reporter.
A Journey Rediscovered, from the King's Lynn magazine of August 2026. Norfolk has always been a place that rewards those who take their time. Its beauty reveals itself in layers, long horizons, gently folding farmland, the sudden rise of a medieval tower above the trees. From riverside rambles and country strolls to tranquil woodland paths, the county offers countless ways to experience its landscapes at a walking pace. Among the most evocative is the King's Lynn to Walsingham Way, a symbolic long-distance route with history at its heart. Launched earlier this summer, it has already inspired a sense of pride among those who helped bring it back to life, while delighting the first walkers setting out to trace its 29 miles from the Wash to one of England's most renowned pilgrimage destinations. That spirit of wonder and enthusiasm was unmistakable at the launch event at King's Lynn Minster, where speeches from passionate local supporters celebrated the trail's heritage, its revival and its future. After the route was blessed, a group of around 35 people set off together on the first 3 miles following Lynn's storied streets out towards the green fringes of South Wootton. The trail begins in the shadow of King's Lynn Minster, a magnificent church founded in 1101 by the Bishop of Norwich, and a place of welcome and prayer for nearly 1,000 years. From here, walkers wind through the town's historic quarter, passing the quiet refuge of All Saints Church before continuing to St Mary's Roman Catholic Church on London Road, a landmark with a prominent place in the pilgrimage story since 1897. The route then leads to the octagonal Red Mount Chapel, one of the county's most distinctive religious landmarks. Built in 1485 as a stopping place for pilgrims journeying to Walsingham, it showcases intricate vaulting and curious carvings and has served a remarkable variety of purposes over the centuries. It's a journey that connects people not just with the landscape, but with centuries of history and faith, says Canon Mark Diamond, a driving force behind the relaunch of the trail. Each stage reveals something new, whether it's a hidden corner of the town or a place that has welcomed travellers for generations. Beyond King's Lynn, the route leads into some of West Norfolk's delightful countryside communities. It passes through the Wootons and into the charming village of Castle Rising, where the vast earthworks of its 12th century castle rise dramatically from their surroundings. From here, the path leads to the historic hamlet of Babbingley, before entering the Sandringham Estate, where the Church of St Mary Magdalene stands serene among the trees. The trail continues through Anmer and into Great Bircham, a natural halfway point known for its traditional cottages, village store and inviting pub. It's a relatively flat and easy route, suitable for all ages and ideal for walking in stages. Most people could comfortably complete it over 2 days, perhaps stopping at Great Bircham, Canon Mark adds. It's not designed for road cyclists, as there are sections that are public bridleways, but that slower pace is part of its appeal. Moving gently through a landscape offers a very different experience from rushing through it as part of everyday travel. For many, this last section will be the most moving. The Holy Mile into Little Walsingham has been walked by pilgrims for centuries, and modern travellers can still feel that history underfoot. The ruins of the medieval priory, alongside the friary, Orthodox chapel, Methodist church, and Roman Catholic shrine, speak to the layers of devotion that have shaped this small but astounding village. Over the past decade, there has been renewed interest in pilgrimage routes across Europe, and the King's Lynn to Walsingham Way forms an important link within that wider network, reflects local historian Dr. Paul Richards, who also played a key role in relaunching the trail. Celebrating local heritage, supporting village economies, and encouraging tourism in Norfolk are all vital. We hope it will inspire people to explore this landscape and appreciate the stories it holds. His enthusiasm is echoed by Philip Eake, Senior Tourism Officer at the Borough Council, who believes the trail also speaks to a growing desire for slower, more mindful travel. Many modern visitors are actively seeking calmer, less crowded, and healthier travel experiences, he says. This trail is not only a reminder of King's Lynn's religious heritage and its historic links to Walsingham, but also an accessible way to explore local wildlife and unspoilt rural areas. What makes the King's Lynn to Walsingham Way so special is not simply its history, scenery, or spiritual resonance, but the way these elements come together. At a time when more people are rediscovering walking as a source of health, reflection, and connection, the trail offers a journey that feels both deeply rooted and newly relevant.
Launching to Save Lives from the King's Lynn magazine, August 2026. The North Norfolk coast can feel vast and timeless, a landscape shaped by wide skies, shifting sands and the slow rhythm of the tide. At Wells next to the sea, that sense of calm can change in an instant. A pager sounds, doors open, engines roar into life. Within minutes, a volunteer crew is racing across sand and shingle towards danger, answering a call that could mean the difference between life and death. That sudden shift defines Wells RNLI, a station rooted not only in its dramatic setting but in generations of dedication. A lifeboat has served this harbour for more than 150 years, And that legacy continues through a team of local volunteers who stand ready to respond at any hour and in any weather. We can be sitting at home and suddenly we're running for the door. We often get down to the station, into our kit and launch out to sea in just 7 minutes, says crew member and water safety officer Mandy Humphreys. It's incredibly fast and we physically can't do it any quicker. But for someone in trouble, those 7 minutes can feel like a lifetime. Mandy joined the Wells crew in 2018, shortly before moving to the town. Having retired early, she was searching for something meaningful to pour her energy into. The RNLI had been part of her life since childhood, as her mother spent more than 50 years volunteering at a local lifeboat station and fundraising for the charity. Yet even with that family connection, Mandy never imagined she would one day be part of a rescue crew herself. I had no maritime background at all and feared I wouldn't be strong enough to pass the test, she says. My gran always said that being scared and doing it anyway is the definition of courage. I just went for it, built my skills from scratch and learned from the local team. It's something I never imagined I could do, but I'm so glad I put myself forward. I'm honestly living my dream. She embraced the role with determination, developing the knowledge needed to operate in one of the most complex and fast-changing coastal environments in the country. Today, she serves on both lifeboats at Wells, the fast and agile inshore boat Peter Wilcox and the larger Shannon-class all-weather lifeboat Duke of Edinburgh. She has built skills in leadership and navigation while also playing a vital role in water safety education, helping people stay safe long before a rescue is ever needed. Life on the crew is defined by unpredictability. There are no set shifts and no fixed routines, only the knowledge that everything can change in a heartbeat. When the pager sounds, the team knows only which boat is needed. The details of the emergency often come later, or not at all until they reach the casualty. It's incredibly reactive, Mandy says. My first thought is always concern because someone is in real trouble. But the moment we're on the boat, the whole crew is focused. Our lives are in each other's hands. There's a real sense of togetherness. The inshore lifeboat is often the one to respond. A small but powerful vessel built for speed in shallow water. Along this coastline, it's frequently called into action to rescue people caught out by tidal cutoff, one of the most common and deceptive dangers the RNLI faces. About 5 out of 6 people we rescue are cut off by the tide, Mandy explains. It moves very quickly here, and many people don't realise they're on a sandbank or out on a remote stretch of beach until the water is already rising around them. For incidents further out to sea or involving larger vessels, the all-weather lifeboat comes into its own, a highly capable craft designed to operate in the most challenging conditions. Both boats are kept ready at all times, refuelled and prepared to launch again after every shout, training session or exercise. Yet what stays with the crew is not just the mechanics of a launch, but the human experience behind each call. Mandy's memories range from the disorienting darkness of her first shout on a November evening, when the crew launched to save a group stranded on marshland, to a recent Easter Sunday call out to 5 teenagers cut off by the tide at Blakeney. "I was about to tuck into an Easter egg when the pager went," she recalled. "It was dark and windy, and the sea still had energy from the storms in the days before. We were being bounced around in the inshore boat and had to wade out to reach them. They were scared, of course they were, but we got them safely ashore." Alongside her operational duties, Mandy dedicates a significant amount of time to water safety, a vital and often unseen aspect of the RNLI's work. Engaging with schools, local organisations and businesses, she helps people understand the risks they may not realise they are taking. Her work ranges from providing tidal cutoff maps to building relationships with beach wardens and car park attendants, encouraging them to pass on safety advice. Education is a simple but powerful tool. If we can help people understand the dangers, we can stop them getting into trouble in the first place, she says. Some of the best lifeguards never actually get wet. They spend time talking to people. It's important that local people feel proud of keeping their communities and visitors safe. That pride runs through the entire operation. While dramatic launches may capture attention, the RNLI depends on a much wider network, from shore crew and fundraisers to shop volunteers and supporters, all contributing to a service that relies entirely on donations and goodwill. For Mandy, that shared effort is what makes it so meaningful. My favourite thing about volunteering for Wells RNLI is being part of something bigger than me, she says. From heading out in difficult conditions to helping people stay safe before they ever need us, it all feels incredibly worthwhile. Visit wellslifeboat.org to learn more about the station's history, access key water safety guidance, and discover ways you can support the local team selflessly saving lives at sea.
Inside the National Trust Mansion with its own secret library, by Lynn Bensley, North Norfolk News. Like the ghost of Anne Boleyn, most who visit Blickling Hall usually desire to return again and again. Blickling is one of the National Trust's finest Jacobean mansions, which also houses the Trust's largest library of 12,500 books that line the shelves of the library beneath the palatial plasterwork of the long gallery ceiling. There was never a better setting for a more prized collection. By far the largest and most significant within the National Trust, it was Sir Richard Ellis of Nocted, that high-minded scholar and bibliophile, who amassed the bulk of the collection. Upon his death in 1742, the collection passed into the Hobart family and was further enlarged by the Lady Caroline Suffield collection, the Lady Constant Talbot collection, and that of Sir Philip Kerr, the 11th Marquess of Lothian. As its last private owner, it was Lord Lothian who bequeathed the hall and its contents to the Trust in 1940. It was a very hot day at the end of June when I visited Blickling to meet property librarian Rebecca Feeks, who explained the part that the book collection is playing in the current Journeys exhibition, which features textiles from the Karan Thacker collection. In keeping with the textile exhibition, we had also planned an exhibition that highlights Blickling's global connections, looking at people associated with Blickling and the countries they have visited and the items they've brought back to the house. We identified Italy, India, France, Japan and Russia as our featured countries, and at the heart of it is our wonderful, wonderful library. Seven magnificent specimens from the collection are currently on display around the house. These include Recollections of India, 1847, by Charles Stuart Harding. Charles went to India as the private secretary of his father, Field Marshal Henry Harding, during the time of the First Anglo-Sikh War. These are actually lithotints done by James Duffield Harding, says Rebecca, using an innovative technique where he has employed a stone rather than a lithograph pen to achieve these lovely washes that look like colour. Though this was a time of unrest and great change in India, there are no scenes of conflict here. These images are very tranquil and serene. It is very much a British gaze, a colonial ideal representing ownership and power. Henry, much impressed by his son's efforts, sent several prints home to the delight of Queen Victoria, who recommended publication. Also on display is 36 Views of Mount Fuji, 1852 to 1858, by Hiroshige, one of the last prominent Japanese ukiyo-e artists. It is an exquisite collection depicting images of Mount Fuji viewed from various locations and in different seasons. He is a master of the gradation of colour that gives this superb soft tone to the images. He is quite different from others in that his focus is on daily life, the weather and the changing seasons. Mount Fuji is never the dominant feature, it's always in the background of these peaceful-looking pictures as he travelled around the provinces. One of the most striking exhibits features the two studio notebooks known as Icones Ipsis Palmtis, circa 1600, by Fabio Colana, a leading Italian botanist who made detailed studies of hundreds of plants and their medicinal uses. A scrupulous observer, Colana has pioneered early nature printing by pressing inked leaves from each specimen onto paper and then finishing the stem and leaves with pen and paint. This method achieved accurate representations of each plant. Such accuracy in one's observations was a product of the scientific age. It may be a point of conjecture among book lovers, but my favourite exhibit is the Grand Atlas, 1663, by the renowned Dutch mapmaker and printer Joan Bleo. This is the French version that came in 12 volumes with over 600 double-mounted colour plates, explains Rebecca. There are volumes dedicated to the Americas, to Asia, to Germany, etc., and taking all in all the known world at the time. There was great rivalry among the map makers of the 16 and 1700s, and the best were coming to the Netherlands. This was due to the combination of their maritime success, both in trade and naval power, and because they were adept at embracing new scientific discoveries and techniques. And in order to trade with the East, you needed maps to get you there and back. Each meticulously hand-coloured map is remarkably accurate for the period, and are undoubtedly the finest examples of the golden age of cartography. Besides the seven books currently on display, visitors are being offered the chance to attend a specialist book tour once a month, when they will be able to view a further 12 volumes from the collection. The book tour is conducted in the Long Gallery, says Rebecca, and is a real opportunity for people to get up close and personal with the books. Although they won't be able to touch them, they will be able to take pictures and view various illustrations. We have some big, bold and beautiful books, and being able to share them with the public is very important to me. Admitting it was impossible to choose a favourite from such a diverse collection, Rebecca gave a much more instructive reply. I don't have a favourite book, but I have favourite elements of books. I love 16th century woodcuts, woodcut tile pages and woodcut initials, and some of the early bindings known as all-over bindings, where the entire cover is decorated with tool designs. These are typically done in blind, which means a heated tool is pressed into the cover material without the use of gold. The current Journeys exhibition is another chapter in the history of Blickling Hall, which also serves to underline the significance of books as the building blocks of civilizations, raised upon the foundation stones of enlightened minds. Anne Boleyn loved books, which may explain why her ghost returns to Blickling every year to wander the Long Gallery and indulge her passion for the written word. It's a never-ending story. People wishing to attend the Specialist Book Tours can book online at Specialist Book Tour 2026, Global Books at Blickling, National Trust.
My Music for You, August 2026, by Clive McCombie. I usually choose four composers as the basis for my monthly offering, but this month I've chosen just one because he's a kind of musical polymath. He was born in New York in September 1898 and, from humble beginnings, played and composed not only classical music, but also classical popular music and jazz. He collaborated with his brother, who wrote many of the words to his songs, and if you haven't already realised who he is, his name is George Gershwin. He was born Jacob Gershwin, with the surname pronounced as Gershwin in the Yiddish-speaking community in which he lived. George Gershwin's father and mother individually moved to America because of increasingly anti-Jewish feeling in Russia after World War I. They met in America, and his father changed his original surname, Gershowitz, to a more anglicised version. George further anglicised the name by dropping the final E at about the same time as he became a professional musician. George left school at the age of 15 and worked as a song plugger, which meant that he promoted music to musicians, publishers, and customers. He then worked for a company producing piano rolls to be played on the old-fashioned pianola. All the time he was working on his own compositions, but it was not until 1919 that he scored his first big national hit with Swanee, which Al Johnson included in one of his final shows. From then on, composing was his prime focus, and in 1924, his first major work, Rhapsody in Blue, for orchestra and piano, was performed. This has become his most popular work, so let's focus on it a little more. It was commissioned by the band leader Paul Whiteman, and the work combines elements of classical music with jazz influences. After its first performance, it was arranged for Pitt Orchestra in 1926, and then a full symphony orchestra version appeared in 1942. The piece established Gershwin's reputation as an eminent composer. Its famous clarinet glissando, which opens the piece, has become as immediately recognisable to concert audiences and university challenge teams as the opening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. If you haven't encountered the Rhapsody, then it is a must. In the same year as this major composition, versatile Gershwin was working on a musical comedy, Lady Be Good, which included an enduring future standard, Fascinating Rhythm. In the following years, American songbook favourites included Embraceable You, I Got Rhythm, Nice Work If You Can Get It, A Foggy Day in London Town, and countless more. He joined the celebrated ranks of composers in this genre, the likes of Irving Berlin and Cole Porter. Before moving on to Porgy and Bess, let me not ignore his Piano Concerto in F, 1925, and An American in Paris, 1928. Again, they are a must for Gershwin fans. Finally then, to the work to which that, as a retired singer, I naturally gravitate, Porgy and Bess from 1935. This was Gershwin and his brother Ira's take on the libretto by Debussy Haywood, which was in turn adapted from the Haywood family's play Porgy. It was composed just 2 years before Gershwin's death from a brain tumour. The cast featured classically trained African-American singers, a daring artistic choice at the time. As it contains jazz, blues, and spiritual idioms, it's officially classified as a folk opera, but as with grand opera, as opposed to operetta, it has a fully orchestrated score and is through-sung, that is, there's no spoken dialogue. Nonetheless, some regarded it as sophisticated musical theatre, and many numbers like Summertime became famous jazz and popular standards. Apart from the main characters of the title, there are colourful characters like Sporting Life, who sings I Got Plenty of Nothing, and the evil Crown, Bess's violent and possessive lover. It's set in the slums of Charleston, where Porgy, a blind beggar, lives. If you don't have time to listen to the whole work, then please choose to listen to Bess, You Is My Woman Now, Summertime, and of course, It Ain't Necessarily So. These are well-deserved, timeless classics. I hope that you will have enjoyed this month's musical history lesson and will also enjoy listening to the music. Until next month, happy listening.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our roving reporter, Sharon White, where she chats to an established foster carer about her experiences.
Hello, Gillian. Thank you so much for talking to us today. Fostering is notoriously challenging, I know.
It is challenging. It was when my children, I've got three children of my own, and they were in their late teens. In fact, the boys were going off to university and my daughter was growing into her teens. I thought, I can't sit and watch telly all day. I better do something else. So then you kind of think, well, what am I any good at? And my usual answer is not a lot. But I thought the one thing I've done well is brought my children up because they're lovely. So that's why we went into it.
I've seen your lovely photo album. Mm. You must have touched so many children's lives over the years. Any idea how many you've actually cared for since the beginning?
I think it's about 40 or 50, considering we did it for 20 years.
Did they tend to stay in touch with you when they moved on or went back to their families?
Some parents do. I mean, if they're young children, it's reliant on the parents, obviously. Some, it's just you see them on Facebook. Some of the older ones, which we had, and in the later years, we did quite a lot of fostering of a mum and babies.
Oh, right.
So they came to us with their baby. One lovely lad that we fostered. When I say lovely lad, when he first came to us as 11, that wasn't probably the adjective most people would have used about him. But bless him, he changed and developed a lot over the 9 years he was with us. And unfortunately, my husband died recently, but he came to his funeral. And I was just so touched. He'd seen that it was on and he said, what a lot. You know, we both meant. When I think what he used to be like, and he'd grown into this absolutely gorgeous 6-foot-something young man, you know, I was getting on with life.
How much notice did you have? Did they just sometimes arrive on very short
sometimes
notice?
Sometimes very short notice. Sometimes it would be planned and you'd have a bit of notice. I remember when we first started, you go through a long process of assessed for it, as you certainly should be. So we were assessed and we were registered to have one child. So we had this one gorgeous little lad, 2-year-old, and I got a phone call one day to say, could we have this other little boy? And I said, well, we're only set to have one. I said, and we've already got him. Be all right. So anyway, the second lad arrives. So then probably weeks after that, I got a phone call one Saturday. Somebody saying, could we have this other lad, a young teenager, about 13? We've already got two. Oh, that'll be all right. And this poor lad actually was at the police station. His family wouldn't have him back and they didn't know what to do with him anyway. So he came to us as well.
And they must have demonstrated some really challenging behaviour.
Yes.
How did you cope?
I mean, actually, that particular lad was a nice young lad. Some of the little ones, if they're very little, because they don't know what's going on. But I can remember two little girls coming to us, which they were brought to us by the police. So there were two, I think I had two policemen each on the children and two policemen to hold the parents. And they were just dragged out of their home, these poor girls. They were about 9 and 10, I think. And within about an hour, they were sitting in my living room eating pizza. You know, it amazes me sometimes how they can not get over the whole thing, but just the first time those particular girls had ever been in care. Unfortunately, they weren't in care too long and they did go home satisfactorily.
What kind of family backgrounds would then mean they would have to come into foster care?
I mean, those particular girls, it was a troublesome father, let's say. So, in fact, he was removed. The police removed him from the house. So, really, once he'd been removed, there was
no
real reason for removing those girls. So they weren't out for too long. So sometimes it might be aggressive behaviour of the parents. It might be drink, unfortunately, drink and drugs. And it's so sad. Two girls that we had for a very, very long while came from a really nice, respectable family and their parents just both drank too much. And you just think, it's no good anyone saying, why don't they stop drinking? Because they obviously couldn't, because I can't believe that if they could stop, because they did love those girls, but they just couldn't.
It is sad.
We had one child where they've a big family and it was the youngest little one we had. Where the father committed suicide suddenly. So it can be absolutely anything. Yeah, a whole mix of things, really.
Was there an average time? Did it tend to be longer term? I know you did have some long term.
No, I mean, it's a funny thing because the expression long term, I used to think meant you had them for a long while. But what in fact long term means is not another plan for them. Short term fostering is they're looking for something else after you. They're looking for someone to either long-term fostering or to be adopted.
Right.
Long-term fostering, once they're in a long-term placement, that's it, they're not looking for anywhere to move them on to.
Oh, I see.
But the first little boy we had him, he came to us for a week and stayed a year and a half. And that was not unusual, to be honest. The lad we had for 9 years at the end, he came to us for a week's respite during a half-term holiday and went home. And when the summer holiday came, I got a phone call saying about this lad, and he'd said, could he come and live with us?
I said, well, that says a lot, doesn't it?
I said, he can come for the summer holiday.
Mm.
So he came for the summer holiday, and then basically they never found anyone else to have him. No. So he stayed with us, and that was fine. I did have to remind him sometimes that it was your idea to come live with us.
And what about your own children? Did they find it, you know, because some of the ones that came perhaps were a bit hard to befriend, however much you wanted to. How did they cope with it?
Because the age they were, the boys could really almost ignore them if they wanted to.
Mm.
My daughter would have her heart broken by the little ones when they were going, really.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was only one child I can remember who really they struggled with, and that was just simply because this lad, and it's absolutely true what they said about him, used to stare. So they'd be sitting watching the television and they could kind of feel his eyes.
Yeah.
He just used to stare at them all the time.
Oh,
and
little,
that really struggled with him.
Did you have any child come that you actually couldn't keep?
I mean, I would say a couple come to mind. One that we had for quite a long while, bless him, we'd been through the mill. We'd been to about every foster carer there was. I didn't want to move him on, but our first health worker said,
yeah,
he's got to go, Jim. She told him he was going to have to move on. And I always remember this because she said, you've got to move on because Gillian's very, very tired. And he came out and said to me,
oh,
what's her name, says, I've got to go because you're very, very tired. I said, oh, did she? So later on, I did have the conversations. I actually, you're going because of your behaviour. I thought, what's the point in him going? And he'll
exactly.
be exactly the same next time. And he probably was, I don't know. But we did. But the nice thing was, when he actually went, a couple of weeks later, I did cry. Because I thought I was going to solve everybody's problems.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they go and you haven't solved their problems, it's a shame. And he said to his social worker later on, I was the only person that ever cried when he left.
Oh.
And I thought, he doesn't know that half an hour later I was saying, yes, freedom again, sort of thing.
And was there one little girl as well? That?
Oh, yes. We did have one little girl that liked to set fire to things in her bedroom, which, I mean, I just didn't sleep when she was with us. And I thought, I cannot keep someone that I never know is going to burn the house down.
Too worrying, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it really was. And I thought, no, just, it didn't work. So she was about the only one that I asked, I think, just move her.
Yeah.
Because I thought, before the house goes up.
And you must have had a lot of fun, though, with the kids and funny stories in the house.
Such lovely times. I mean, we have had all sorts. We had one little lad. And, I mean, this was nothing to do with being fostered, really. But it's when we had the two girls that we'd had for a long while, and we had this little lad at the same time. He was about 4 or 5. And he called to me. I was in the lounge. And he said, Gillian, I said, yes, stop. He said, there's a frog in the hall. Mm. And we had a table that was probably about 2 inches off the ground. And I thought, really? I said, honestly? He said, really, Gillian? It's a real frog. And I, went, and I went out there, and he was quite right. And it was right by this table. And I thought, that frog's going to jump under that table, and I won't be able to get it out. So I put my foot there quickly, between the frog and the table, to which the frog promptly jumped up my trouser leg. This little lad was absolutely in hysterical laughter, as were the two girls. And I just hobbled over to the window in the lounge, where the little pond was outside, opened the window, put my hand up my trouser leg, got the frog and dropped it out. But they were just all, they were just in hysterics, which was nice. So, I mean, there is lots of fun. We've had lovely times. We took 3 of them to Euro Disney once, which was lovely.
Oh, gosh,
when I look at the photos, and I think, lots of it has been lovely. Some of it, to be honest, has been horrific. We had 3 sisters once, and I said to my husband, I swear they take it in turns to misbehave. And one morning, I heard them on the landing, and one of them said to the other one, it's your turn today. And I thought, they really do.
Well, that was really interesting. And thanks again. It was lovely talking to you.
My pleasure.
Thank
you. Absolutely my pleasure.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate section of articles include parking concerns at Tesco, jet skiers warned, seal pup bite, and fishing boats' new lease of life.
Locals have called for year-round parking restrictions at a Tesco Express on the coast in the hope to stop cars blocking up a village. The shop in Munsley has limited parking capacity, causing customers to park on the road. Liberal Democrat councillor Mal Gray visited the area to meet people living near the Cromer Road store who are experiencing problems. This follows a consultation which proposed yellow line restrictions, with some arguing they should operate all year. Mr. Gray said he supported year-round restrictions after visiting the site. vehicles parking along the road and pavement can significantly reduce the available road width, meaning traffic sometimes must move into the opposing lane to get through, he said on a social media post. He said people also raised concerns about motorists parking close to gates and property accesses.
Jet skiers on the North Norfolk coast have been warned that dangerous behaviour will be reported to police after a spate of near misses. It comes after a number of beachgoers and swimmers were put at risk this summer. So much so that North Norfolk District Council has been forced to remind jet skiers of the rules. There have been a few reports this summer where jet skiers have nearly endangered swimmers and beach users. So if you're going out on the water with a jet ski, please know the rules and tips around appropriate jet skiing, a spokesman for the authority said. Pick a suitable and quiet location on the beach to launch. Safest launch beaches include Sea Pauling, Vale Road and Cart Gap. There is a privately managed launching service available at Sea Pauling. Control your speed and keep it as low as possible close to the shore. Jet skiers were also reminded not to launch or ski near where people are swimming or near lifeguarded beaches and to remember to wear appropriate safety equipment. A firm warning was also issued that any such irresponsible behaviour would be reported to police.
A long dormant fishing boat is getting a new lease of life for future generations of a family who love spending time on the sea. Knot 3, built in 1972 for the late Gerald Bullard of Bullard's Brewery in Norwich, has been restored by Stiffkey-based boat builders David Hewitt and Tom Gathercole at the request of Mr. Bullard's grandson, Harry. She took to the water at Morstan Quay near Holt for the first time on Saturday, complete with her new engine and pristine paint job after being coaxed off her trailer by Mr. Hewitt and Mr. Gathercole. As she went afloat and her new engine chugged into life, Mr. Bullard said, "It's amazing. It's stunning. Talk about a work of art. I also feel a pang of pride seeing grandfather's boat back on the water." Knot 3 had been laid up for 2 decades and her refit took 10 months. Generations of the Bullard family turned out for the launch, with some on board another craft called Knot and a gleaming wooden yacht called Ork. Gerald Bullard had a love for the North Norfolk coast and its working boats. In 1960, he commissioned a boat from Warfork Brothers of King's Lynn and named it Knot when it was completed in 1963. He asked the builders to order timber for a second boat, and in 1972, they informed him that his new vessel, now Knot 3, was ready. After his death in 1989, the 1963 boat was recommissioned by the family, and in the 1990s with a new water-cooled engine. The 1972 vessel was laid up until now. The Bullard's connection to working boats dates back to 1938, when Gerald commissioned his first Knot, a Welker built by R.E. Emery of Sheringham. He used the boat for fishing before joining the Royal Navy at the outbreak of the Second World War. He sold the boat to fisherman Diddy Cooper because he believed it was wrong to leave a working vessel idle during wartime when it could be out catching food. Wendy Pritchard, founder of the Stiffkey-based charity Rescue Wooden Boats, was on the quayside to see the launch. She said anyone who sees her will be in awe of the quality of the work, which is a wonderful tribute to the skills David and Tom have and their untiring efforts to keep the historic wooden boats at North Norfolk as living and much enjoyed parts of the fishing heritage of the coast. Mr. Hewitt and his brother George have been building and restoring boats for 50 years. "It doesn't matter how old I am," he said when the subject cropped up in quayside conversation. "You'd have to cut a limb off and count the rings to find that out."
A woman has been left needing plastic surgery after being bitten by a seal pup. The bite saw the volunteer from the Friends of Horsey Seals spend 3 nights in hospital due to the severity of the injury. The incident at Horsey Beach happened despite the team member being trained and experienced in handling seals and following strict protocols to minimise risk. A spokesman for FOHS said the pictures give a graphical representation of the damage a seal can cause. This bite was inflicted on one of our FOHS rescue team members last week, who are trained and experienced in handling seals. We follow strict protocols when undertaking rescues, which are in place to minimise risk to both the seal and the team member, but it's absolutely impossible to eliminate all risk. This particular bite was from a seal pup, not an adult seal, so it could have been much, much worse. The damage warranted a 3-night stay in hospital with a requirement for plastic surgery. The woman is now out of hospital and in great spirits, the charity confirmed, following the incident on August 15th. This summer, FOHS has been responding to a number of incidents involving seals, with members of the public helping to protect the animals until help arrives. But the charity has again warned people to stay away from the mammals due to the dangers. The public are still getting far too close, especially children, the spokesman added. Grey seals are beginning to gather for the upcoming breeding season. The females are heavily pregnant and the males are getting aggressive. New signage has been put up, but people are not heeding the warnings.
Tributes have been paid after the death of a much-loved Wroxham Parish councillor. Ian Joynson, who died on August the 1st, was described as kind and generous by the parish council. Mr. Joynson managed the council's speed monitoring devices, defibrillators at the church hall, and reviewed tree planning applications. Wroxham Parish Council said, "Ian consistently went above and beyond in his commitment to Wroxham and its community. He provided invaluable oversight of the council's financial matters and took a hands-on approach to maintenance issues at the playgrounds, public seating and other council assets. He took an active interest in all aspects of parish council business, always willing to help, offer his knowledge and experience and get involved wherever he could make a difference. The huge contribution Ian made to the parish council and to the wider community leaves a vast hole that will be incredibly difficult to fill. His knowledge, dedication, practical approach and willingness to help will be greatly missed, but so too will his friendship, good humour and companionship as a fellow councillor." Mr. Joynson's funeral was held on August the 21st. The considerable turnout was a true reflection of the affection and respect in which Ian was held and of his kind, generous and caring nature, the parish council added.
A countryside route through North Norfolk has been named among the best places in the UK for a pub walk. The list, written by The Sun, details the best pub walks around the country. The writer chose a special spot in Norfolk as one of the best places. The scenic route starts in Aldborough and takes in three churches, a village common and Big Skies. It ends at the Cricketers on the Green, a pub serving monthly changing dishes from its AA Rosette winning kitchen made from the freshest Norfolk ingredients with views over the pitch where summer cricket is played. The pub is run by Julie Bacon and her husband. Nearby, Dibley Cottage offers a cosy stay for four near North Walsham. Other places included in the roundup were Yorkshire, the Peak District and South Wales.
A pub landlord has hailed the transformation of a 230-year-old premises into the heart of the community as it's put up for two national awards. The Black Swan in North Walsham, now a not-for-profit venue with a fully functioning theatre, is being celebrated for its reinvention and is in the running for two national awards at the Great British Pub Awards. I always say the Black Swan, established in 1730, reinvented 2023, is how Joseph Ballard, chief executive of New Stages, describes his venture. He added, "I like to think I've reinvented a new sort of pub, where yes, we do beers and we do food, but also we've got the theatre, which is our biggest asset. Mr. Ballard took over the pub in October 2023 after learning it was under threat of demolition and could have been turned into housing if a landlord could not be found. Backed by his choir group, he led a two-week volunteer effort to clean and redecorate the building, with more than 60 locals volunteering their time and support. People would turn up with paintbrushes and overalls, and they'd say, "I've got 2 hours," and they'd spend 10 hours with us, he said. "I used to get emotional every day thinking about what we've achieved." The theatre was transformed in January 2024 with help from 40 volunteers and now hosts professional touring shows, stand-up comedy and community events. It also serves as a space for groups, including yoga classes, women's wellness sessions and, of course, the choir. Mr. Ballard is also a therapist and offers free or low-cost therapy sessions from a discreet space above the pub as part of the business. What we're finding is a lot of people then come to our choir, acting group or coffee group, and actually their well-being is being looked after, not just through therapy, but by joining a social group, he said. He describes the Black Swan as a place where everyone belongs and says many regulars feel a sense of ownership. All profits are reinvested into community projects, theatre improvements and running costs. The Black Swan is now celebrating being a finalist in two categories at the Great British Pub Awards, Best Community Pub and Best Pub for Entertainment. Mr. Ballard said, "We're in the top six in the country for Best Community Pub of the Year and also in the top six of the country for the Best Pub for Entertainment. It's really exciting, not just for me and the volunteers and all the work that goes into it, but also for the town." Mr. Ballard's partner, Rudy Jordan, has opened a pizzeria next to the theatre, bringing more footfall to the market town's community pub.
A popular beach in Norfolk has been ranked among the UK's best. Sea Pawling secured fifth place in a national ranking based on TripAdvisor reviews and average temperatures. The roundup, compiled by The Thinking Traveller, highlighted the array of natural beauty and outstanding coastal experiences found across the UK. Embleton Bay in Northumberland placed fourth, just ahead of Sea Pawling. Sandbanks in Dorset topped the list with a TripAdvisor rating of 4.6 from 1,919 reviews and an average peak air temperature of 20.8 degrees Celsius. A spokesman for The Thinking Traveller said, "Sea Pawling Beach is the UK's fifth best beach, combining a high rating score, 4.7 out of 5, with mild air, 19 degrees, and sea, 16.8 degrees, temperatures during peak months. Whether you prefer a vibrant, family-friendly atmosphere or a peaceful scenic escape, there's something for everyone on this list." Other top contenders included Botany Bay in Kent, which finished second, St Andrew's West Sand in Scotland, which finished third, and Embleton Bay in Northumberland, which ranked fourth.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your return memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
We say farewell to our reader, Tony Escrit, and thank him for his contributions. The sound engineer today was Richard Preston. Editing and producing this issue was Manny Gomez. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's cheerio.